welcome to our second Dr. Thibault study, and here's Howard.
Hi, everybody. I guess we'll start with the set aside prayer. Dear God, please set aside everything I think I know about myself, this book, my disease, these steps, and especially about you, dear God, so that I might have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. You tell me the truth. Amen. That looks like a variation on what I'm used to saying, but I just grabbed it off the web real quick. Okay, so we're going to go through the second chapter in the Thibault papers, the after surrender and the therapeutic process with special reference to alcoholism. And what we're going to, he's going to show an example of surrender in kind of a psychiatric context with a patient of his. And he's going to talk about what goes into surrender and what its significance is for alcoholics. And he's going to start talking about the structure of the alcoholic ego. So he's going to use the word ego a couple of times here. He's not going to go into, as he does elsewhere, into great detail about the term ego, which is fraught. If you're talking to psychiatrists, it's got a lot of history. And he doesn't go into that here. But I have added to the website, Thibault.egbach.com, a section in the vocabulary page for ego that goes through those discussions. But we won't really get into that until we get to the paper on the ego factors. But we're also going to look at a little bit at his idea of the structure of the alcoholic ego, which he goes into in depth in that ego factors paper. And then he's going to also talk about surrender versus compliance in this paper a little bit. And Suzanne, I'm not sure how far we're going to get. If we go by the amount of reading we did last week, about halfway through, this is about twice the size of what we did, and about halfway through is the difference between submission and surrender. So we go up to that point and see how much time we have.
Yeah,
that's on page 22 or 23.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we thought we'd go up to about, let's see. Yeah, 23 was where we were going to stop.
Okay. I've got page numbers now in the latest version. I deleted the book off Kindle on my computer and re-downloaded it. Now it has page numbers, so I'm a little bit more likely to be able to be on the same page. So that's the outline of the paper. And the takeaway for me is that surrenders, the ego resists in the subconscious, and the ego has to give way in order to have a surrender. And it's got to be deep and effective. So shall I start?
Please do.
Okay. So the act of surrender in the therapeutic process with special reference to alcoholism. Introduction, the importance of a positive attitude. A year and a half ago, I wrote a paper in which I discussed a phenomenon that I labeled conversion. In that paper, I broadened the concept of conversion to cover any major switch from negative to positive thinking and feeling, irrespective of a possible religious component. Two points stood out to me as important. First, the fact that the positive frame of mind could appear under a given set of circumstances without special help, psychiatric or otherwise. And second, that the new state of mind had a decidedly healthier tone to its thinking and feeling than that which prevailed when the negative tone was uppermost. Without specifically saying so, I then believed that the positive frame of mind could become a legitimate aim in therapy as, once it was brought about, the individual's attitudes and responses were much healthier. While I no longer believe that therapy is simply a matter of reaching a positive relationship with reality, I remain convinced that the creation of a positive attitude is one of the essential features in a successful therapeutic program, and that any experience that brings about such an attitude or frame of mind deserves therapy study for the light it may throw on treatment in general. Consequently, I continued my observations on the conversion experience and have arrived at the conclusion that the key to an understanding of that experience may be found in the act of surrender, which in my opinion sets in motion the conversion switch. My paper will therefore consist of 1, a discussion of the act of surrender, and 2, an endeavor to relate it to the therapeutic process as a whole.
Howard, before you go on, let me mute the line. So go ahead and unmute yourself, Howard, and continue. Thank you. Press star 6.
Right. I was actually going to pass at that point. That was 2 paragraphs, so why don't you go ahead?
Before I go ahead, it may be wise to recapitulate the contents of a previous paper. In it, I described how with the conversion switch, many aspects of the patient's attitude underwent profound and often remarkable alterations. I pointed out how in 8 major ways the individual switched or changed. Rather than go through the whole list again, I can sum up these changes briefly by saying that the person who has achieved the positive frame of mind has lost his or her tense, aggressive, demanding, conscious-rooted self that feels isolated and at odds with the world and has become a relaxed, natural, more realistic individual who can dwell in the world on a live-and-let-live basis. The difference in the before and after state of these people is very real and represents, I believe, a fundamental psychic occurrence. So why don't we stop there and discuss what we've read so far?
Okay, well, he's talking about the step 1 surrender, right?
Mm-hmm.
And coming to terms with the reality that I'm powerless over alcohol. So he's talking about the positive phase that follows on that and this change in tone, and that's reminiscent of the book There's a Solution, where Dr. Jung tells Roland that he's looking for to try to create an emotional rearrangement. And these appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding force of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. So that's the conversion experience that he's referring to. And so that's step 1, and in a nutshell is what he's talking about.
Does anybody else want to add anything, or I'll continue to read another paragraph? I'll continue. The art of surrender with respect to the act of surrender, let me emphasize this point. It is an unconscious event not willed by the patient, even if he or she should desire to do so. It can occur only when an individual with certain traits in his or her unconscious mind becomes involved in a certain set of circumstances. Then the act of surrender can be anticipated with considerable accuracy, as I shall soon show. It cannot be defined in direct conscious terminology, but must be understood in all its unconscious ramifications before its true inner meaning can be glimpsed. The simplest way to picture what is involved in the act of surrender is to present a case in which there was a conversion experience that seemed to follow an act of surrender. Aaron, you're next.
One man's story. The patient is a man in his early 50s, very successful in business, and referred to by his associates as Napoleon because of his autocratic methods when he was stirred up. For years, heavy drinking to the point of frequent intoxication was present, interfering to some extent with his efficiency, but never to the degree that his business really suffered. My first contact came some 6 or 7 years ago. when he came to Blythewood to dry out. Pursuant to our policy of trying slowly and from time to time to educate patients about the danger of their condition, we permitted this man to remain just for the drying out, at the same time telling him that in our eyes he was headed for trouble if he continued on his present trend. Without putting any pressure on him and thus arousing his resistance, we placed the facts before him and let it go at that. We continued the policy of letting him come and go pretty much as he pleased, always, however, keeping uppermost before him the need to do something about his drinking, and always making it evident that we were not interested in drying him out, but in the real problem of helping him to stop his drinking. Later on, and in retrospect, the patient, in referring to these tactics, said, "I used to like to come here. You didn't always argue with me. I always knew just where you stood and knew I wasn't fooling you any." Pass.
Terry?
During all this time, however, I was working on his life situation so that ultimately it would provide the necessary dynamic to draw him loose from his world of self-centeredness. Gradually, his wife gave up her protectiveness, and before the time of this last admission nearly 2 years ago, she had determined to leave him if his drinking continued. Moreover, as a result of some discussion with me, his business partner had decided that he, with several key members of the firm, would tender their resignation if the patient did not make a real effort to mend his ways. After a particularly severe bout, the patient was introduced again to enter Blythewood. This time, however, I told him flatly that if he would sign himself in for 30 days or he would go elsewhere, we were through with him, running his case once and for all. He looked startled, picked up his hat, fiddled with it, and then put it on his head, saying, "Where's your pen? I'll go to Hilltop where I belong," referring to the cottage where he had dried out on previous occasions. Within 3 or 4 days, he was off the liquor and thinking reasonably straight. He was then informed that his wife's decision, instead of running around and making clear where she could go, he discussed for the first time the real hell he had put her through and really seemed regretful. By the end of the first week, quite prepared for trouble, the partner told him of the pending resignation if the drinking persisted, only to be surprised and pleased with the patient's quiet acceptance of the decision and acknowledgement of his own real wish to be different. He soon joined AA and is now an active member of that organization in its home community. The patient has to date stayed sober. Pass.
Would you like to discuss that one man's story, Howard?
Well, yeah, he's showing a hitting bottom event, right, and a surrender to powerlessness. It's not happening in a context that we recognize, but you know that's our step one, our admission of powerlessness is basically can happen in lots of different contexts. I know mine was despair over being unable to control a job that I was in. I'd been promoted past my competence, and I didn't have liquor to lean on, and I hit bottom that way. And this guy hits bottom because his friends and his wife withdraw support, and then his psychiatrist tells him to he's not going to take his bullshit anymore. Excuse me, BS anymore. So we're looking at a hitting bottom and an initial surrender. Thibault says at the beginning that that this can happen in any circumstances, not necessarily under therapy. And so that's what I think.
Does anybody want to comment?
Hi, Suzanne. This is Karen. Thank you for your awesome comments, Howard. Reading this again today, it came to me that, and I identify with this from my own experience and also with working with other people, it's almost as if this surrender happens when everything, the ability to actually control any of this is finally gone. When there's absolutely nowhere to go, there's nowhere to turn, everybody's gone. You know, when you hear in a meeting, the jig is up. And it's almost like when it's taken out of our hands, and you know how they say that the attitude, the positiveness comes? It's because we're relieved. And that's what that surrender felt like to me. And when I'm reading this, I'm realizing that, you know, that part of us that makes us who we are, that's going to fight to the bitter end, we really want the bitter end to happen. That's just what I get out of this.
Yeah, and I did looked up. I recalled was talking about the positive phase, and big book more about alcoholism. No. 12 by 12. In step 7, he says, "We have finally admitted without reservation we were powerless over alcohol. We are apt to breathe a great sigh of relief, saying, 'Well, thank God that's over.'" So that's one entree to the positive phase.
Does anybody else want to share? Then we'll go on with Stephanie.
Oh, I was just going to, this is Terry, I was just going to, as I read this, I kept thinking where it says in the big book, you know, circumstances made him willing. And that's how I look at it. You know, my own recovery, like, I had to have certain circumstances in order for me to be willing to do something different. And I looked at this man, you know, he was accountable for his behavior. He was, finally accountable for his behavior and his consequences for his actions. And I think when you are out of options, it makes you kind of look in a different direction. That's how I get things.
Yeah, he's facing reality, which is Tebow's noting very strongly. This is it's an adjustment to reality. You know, you've got nowhere to go, and he's going to discuss why I haven't been in touch with reality up to now, and subsequent paragraphs here. So,
we'll have Stephanie continue.
What happened? Recently, in discussing his experience, the man in the story explained, "You did something to me when you made me sign that card. I knew you meant business. I knew my wife was getting sore and that Bill, his partner, was fed up. But when you showed me you were through fooling, that was the clincher. I knew I needed help and couldn't get out of it myself. So I signed the card and felt better right off for doing it. I made up my mind that I wasn't going to run my own case any longer, but was going to take orders. Then later I talked with Chris, his wife, and learned how she felt, and then Bill came along, and I knew deep inside my heart they were right. But I didn't mind. I didn't get angry and want to argue like I used to. I kind of surprised myself by agreeing with them. It sure was nice not to have to fight. I felt calmer and quieter inside, and have ever since, although I know I'm not out of the woods yet. Here is a story of a patient who has been through a conversion experience and is still in the positive phase. His own account of what happened stresses the signing of the card as the turning point in his experience, and I am also convinced that he is right. We can sum this man's experience up by saying that after trying to run his own case to his own ruination, he gave up the battle and surrendered to the need for help, after which he entered a new state of mind that has enabled him to remain sober."
Howard, would you like to comment?
Well, that's the conversion in a nutshell, right? That moment of clarity, you know, we'll call it, you know, when reality comes clear and I accept the reality that, you know, and I get this shift in my consciousness. I get, you know, I'm seeing the world differently. I'm seeing that I can't control it, you know. And I know that when that happened to me, that, you know, there was, it's you know, it's a moment of desperation, right? But it's got the light at the end of the tunnel, you know, and there was this sigh of relief, you know, when I at last faced the truth about me, which is, you know, I couldn't manage my life and I couldn't manage my drinking and I was an alcoholic. And, you know, he's describing that here taking place in a therapeutic context.
Would anyone else like to share? So we'll continue with Bob.
Okay, breaking down the act of surrender. This man's experience, which is not limited to alcoholics, raises three questions. What qualities were there in his nature that so long resisted help and finally were forced to give in? What were the circumstances that brought about the final act of surrender? Why does a positive phase follow the surrender experience? My answers to these questions are derived primarily from my studies of alcoholics, but not entirely, as I have witnessed surrender with a typical aftermath in at least four cases among the students at Sarah Lawrence. I hope through my discussion in reply to these questions not only to define the act of surrender, but also to give you some feeling for it as a psychological entity or event. Internal qualities. To turn then to the first question, what are the qualities in a patient's nature that make him or her put up such a battle before finally surrendering? In the alcoholic, my observations have led me to see that the two qualities that Stillman selected as characteristic, defiant individuality and grandiosity, may very well explain that the alcoholic is typically resistant to the point of being unreasonable and stubborn about seeking help or being able to accept help even when he or she seeks it. Defiant individuality and grandiosity operate in the unconscious layers of the mind, and their influence must be understood if one is to see what probably goes on at the time of surrender. Pass.
Howard, yes, do you want to make any comment?
Yeah, so he's taking a look at the alcoholic ego. This is his first pass in this book, describing the nature of the ego that resists the surrender. And his ideas will change over the years and get kind of more detailed, but this is the first example we see in this book, and he's identifying characteristic defiant individuality and grandiosity as the two factors. He's going to expand on that list later.
Thank you. Anybody else want to share?
Hi, Suzanne. This is Karen. Hi, everyone. I love this part of this paper because, you know, if we want to see, like, right up close and personal these characteristics, read Bill's story, because for me, I just, Bill is all over this, because defiant individuality and grandiosity, all the things that Bill did to try to show the world how important he was and how he had arrived, you know, just the... you know, his grandiosity of coming back from over there with the idea that, you know, hadn't my people made me a leader, and how he saw himself. And then just when he tried to get people to back him when he wanted to go out and speculate, nobody would, and he went off and did it himself. Those are the things, and when I read that, I realize how much of that I had in myself. I always had to be just slightly different from everyone, and I always had ideas of how far that was going to take me. So, I mean, I get the chills when I read this, because I realize just, you know, how blessed we are to have this information. Thanks.
Anyone else like to share? We'll go on with defiance with Lee.
Defiance. Defiance may be defined as a quality that permits an individual to snap his fingers in the face of reality and live on unperturbed. It has two special values for handling life situations. In the first, defiance, certainly with alcoholics, is a surprisingly effective tool for managing anxiety or reality, both of which are so often a source of anxiety. If you defy or a fact and say it is not so and can succeed in doing so unconsciously, you can drink to the day of your death. Forever defying the imminence of that fate. As one patient phrased it, my defiance was a cloak of armor, and so it was a most trustworthy shield against the truth and all its pressures. In the second place, defiance masquerades as a very real and reliable source of inner strength and self-confidence, since it says in essence, nothing can happen to me because I can and do defy it. With people who meet reality on this basis, life is always a battle with the spoils going to the strong. Much can be said in favor of defiance as a method of meeting life. It is the main resource of the chin-up and unafraid type of adjustment, and as a temporary measure, it helps people over many rough spots.
Howard, would you like to share?
Well, imminent means about to happen. So, where am I? Lost the page.
18 and 19.
Yeah. Right, so if you've got something bad about to happen and you can snap your fingers at it, you're in good shape, right, psychologically. You know, and so I'm defiance is a good defining characteristic of my character. You know, it's, I could go on and on about how defiance works for me, but Tebow's pinpointing this is a big, obvious red hot button on the forehead of every alcoholic he's ever seen. It's basically you can see why it stands in the way of a surrender, right? Because I'm not gonna admit anything as long as I'm standing there with that stance, shaking my fist at the world and saying, you know, no, this is the way it is. I'm not gonna listen to you. And he says it's an effective tool for managing anxiety. So, like, you know, in a normal way, It can be even admirable, but in alcoholics, we use it to keep away a reality that's going to kill us.
So this is Suzanne, and I thought it was interesting that what it says in, like, I believe it's the first paragraph, that defiance manages anxiety. And I thought of, started thinking about, and I just opened this question up to the group, what's the difference here between defiance and denial? Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
Well, defiance is active, right? And denial, I can say, well, I don't believe that. The defiance says, I'm going to take arms against that, you know. I guess there's an element of denial in defiance, but defiance implies actually standing up and doing something.
Thank you.
Yes, Suzanne, this is Karen. You know, the greatest example of that is when I think of one of the definitions of insanity is repeating a behavior, knowing the result and doing it anyway. You know, we stand up even though, we can even only be half in denial, and we're going to defy it anyway. So it's kind of it's kind of one of those things where we stand on our fists in the face of whatever it is, whatever the truth is, and we're going to go over it. Thanks.
Anybody else want to make any comments?
Yeah, I do. This is Stephanie. I think a defiance, there's an acknowledgement there, like, I know things are the way that they are, and I'm not interested in doing anything different. And there's I don't know, like an aggressiveness about it. But in denial, it seems like there's really like this minimization, like I'm minimizing things, and I'm more passive about it. You know, that was my thought. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's interesting because actually when I said the defiance implies action, it's more often in my mind, it's inaction, it's being stubborn or not moving.
Shall we go on? Howard, would you like to read Grandiosity?
Okay, Grandiosity. Grandiosity, the second quality noted by Silman, permeates widely through the reactions of the alcoholic. Differing from defiance, which seems almost uniquely structuralized in the psyche of the alcoholic, I am not sure what that means. He's going to say that grandiosity comes from the ego, and maybe defiance doesn't, but I don't understand the distinction. Maybe somebody can help with that. It seems almost uniquely structuralized in the psyche of the alcoholic. Grandiosity springs from the persisting infantile ego. Infantile means of the infant, right? And basically it's the child ego that most people have left behind and that we haven't. This is his first use of the term ego in this paper, and he's not going to go into any more detail about it. But he's going to call it the childish ego in a couple of sentences. Differing from defiance, which seems almost uniquely structuralized in the psyche of the alcoholic, grandiosity springs from the persistent infantile ego. As in other neurotic states, grandiosity characteristically fills a person with feelings of omnipotence, demands for direct gratification of wishes, and a proneness to interpret frustration as evidence of rejection and lack of love. And I love that sentence. Back on the site, I have a definition of omnipotence, which is it means all-powerful. And it's often said, you know, of an omnipotent God in theology. But it basically means having unlimited or universal power, authority, or force. And also in psychology, an infantile perception that the outside world is part of the organism and within it, which leads to a primitive feeling of all-powerfulness. So that's a technical definition and a kind of more modern one that Thibault is using. So did I make a hash of understanding that? Basically, omnipotence results from the grandiosity. And we demand direct gratification of wishes. And we interpret frustration as evidence of rejection and lack of love. The effect of this persistence in the alcoholic is not a bit different from the effect in any other neurotic. Perhaps in the alcoholic, the typical arrogance and sense of superior worth are kept nearer the surface by the associated defiance that feeds the childish ego constantly by its succession of victories. By and large, however, there is nothing in the alcoholic's grandiosity that distinguishes him or her from the neurotic whose infantile ego survives to become a significant factor in adult life. It is part of the typical egocentricity of that group, and its presence is confirmed by any careful study of them. So he's saying that the defiance interacts with the grandiosity in a unique way in alcoholics. So, pass.
Would anybody Howard, else like to comment?
Yes, Howard, this is Lee. I have a couple of questions. About four lines down where he talks about it starts off and says, and a proneness to interpret frustration as evidence of rejection and lack of love. What does that mean?
Well, he's going to talk about this later when he talks about the ego factors. And basically we don't like getting stopped, right? We're like a child, we're moving straight ahead. And if we get stopped, we get easily frustrated, and if we get frustrated, we're looking to pin that on somebody. And so we say, you're stopping me, so you don't love me, you reject me. So it's a kind of a psychological view of the way the alcoholic views frustration, being stopped.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you said something, I thought you said, where was that? The grandiosity and the, what was it, the two you said that go together, the defiancing grandiosity?
Yeah. Right. He's, in the next paragraph, he's going to go into depth of that. Basically, he's saying that the grandiosity you see in the alcoholic isn't any different from any other neurotic, some other patient that isn't an alcoholic but has a mental problem. They may be grandiose, but then in the alcoholic, you combine it with the defiance and you get a unique result. You get, you know, double trouble.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Anybody else, or we'll have Howard continue with another paragraph? Howard?
Okay. Defiance and grandiosity at work in the alcoholic. We are now in a position to discuss how these qualities operate in alcoholics. On the one side, the defiance says, it is not true that I can't manage drinking. On the other side, the facts speak loudly and with increasing insistence to the contrary. Again, on one side, grandiosity claims there is nothing I cannot master and control. And on the other side, the facts demonstrate unmistakably the opposite. The dilemma of the alcoholic is now obvious. The unconscious mind rejects, through its capacity for defiance and grandiosity, what the conscious mind perceives. Hence, realistically, the individual is frightened by his or her drinking, and at the same time is prevented from doing anything about it by the unconscious activity that can and does ignore or override the conscious mind. So that's a critical observation on his part. We call that cognitive dissonance today, basically, you know, trying to have two opposing thoughts in your mind at the same time, right? It's like, I'm fine, but oh my God, you know, I'm dying. There's a bit of a conflict there. And he says that's stemming from the from those unconscious ego factors that he discussed.
So I'll continue. Let us see how this clash between the conscious and unconscious response manifests itself in the clinical setting. A stimulus from reality, such as recognition of the downhill pattern of the drinking, impinges upon the subconscious mind and creates acute anxiety that for the moment dominates the conscious processes and is recorded as worry, distress, fear, and concern. The patient in this state is filled with a desire to quit and eagerly grabs at any kind of help. He or she is in a state of crisis and suffering. In the meantime, however, the stimulus of reality is hitting the unconscious layers of the mind and is stirring up the reactions of defiance and grandiosity. Since characteristically it takes a certain amount of time before the unconscious responses are significantly mobilized to influence conscious mental activity, there is always an appreciable lag before the conscious mind evidences signs of the underlying unconscious activity. Then slowly and gradually these attitudes supervene. Patients express less concern about their drinking, complain that they were rushed into seeking help, that they're no worse than anybody else, and that the worry of others is silly and a gratuitous invasion of their rights. Finally, the memory of their own acute period of anxiety is swallowed up by the defiance and grandiosity. Thus, the patient loses the effectiveness of the anxiety as a stimulus to create suffering and a desire for change. The cycle will go on repeating itself as long as the defiance and the grandiosity continue to function with unimpaired vigor. Howard, would you like to comment?
Well, there's a lot in that, isn't there? I mean, it's pretty dense. Through some vocabulary words, let's see. I don't see the words that I. Oh, supervene means come ahead of or come on top of. So you get these attitudes. You know, reality has made its impression on me. I know that I got a problem. You know, and the point is that in the moment I'm gonna say, oh my God, I got a problem. But that the ego, the defiance and the grandiosity build up underneath, and they take a while to come back and say, no, you're okay. And, you know, and there's that quote in the book about being unable to recall with sufficient force the pain and misery of last night's bender. I'm paraphrasing that. But that's what he's describing here, is that the ego basically says, no, I'm okay, you know. The defiance says, I'm all right. They work together to basically overcome that anxiety that comes from coming in contact with reality, like, you know, a terrible hangover or I lost my car or whatever.
Anybody else?
Hi, yeah, it's Karen again. This is great stuff. Thank you, Howard, for all your comments and everybody else. This is classic. All right, classic. You know, like Howard just said, you know, when you got a hangover and you feel like crap and then all of a sudden it's gone and you're like, yeah, that wasn't that bad. Like in the book when it says, yeah, thanks for the information, but I'm not that bad. I'm not going to get that bad, but thanks anyway. Paraphrasing, of course. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's when somebody is still using on the fence, you know, not conceding to their innermost self, I don't really have a problem. And then a person who starts this work and starts to get their life back and starts resting on their laurels, and all of a sudden, oh, no, it wasn't that bad. It's so classic, those parts of us, this defiance and grandiosity. We do not have the goods to actually dig back most of the time and remember how horrible this was. So this is a really huge and important paragraph. Thank you.
Oh, it's Suzanne. And I also, when I was reading this, I started thinking about people who come in, they think they're, you know, on the ground, ready to, you know, work a program and, you know, or, you know, feel like, you know, they're just really, really upset and just, you know, so grateful, you know, to have found a program or, you know, want to kind of get into it and start moving, and then like the next day or a couple of weeks later or whatever, it's either kind of back to their old self again. So it's nice to be able to have Dr. Thibeault really explain this, and it helps me like really kind of understand people who are going in and out of the program. Thanks. Anybody else want to share? Then we'll continue on with Karen with external circumstances.
External circumstances. We now come to the second question. What were the circumstances that made that patient give in and sign that card? Let me review them for you briefly. He had been drinking for years, and he knew his drinking was getting worse in the eyes of family and friends.
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I can hardly hear you.
Okay. However, he knew that his condition had reached the point where both his wife and his business associates were leaving him and thereby withdrawing their support and protection. He was threatened with the task of managing himself and his condition entirely on his own, so he sought my help and protection to dry him out and thus allow him once more to resume his role of successful defiance and grandiosity. This time, however, I refused to follow my previous role. I had established myself as not arbitrary, not willing to fit what he needed. But when I asked him to sign the card, I knew that his other circumstances were different and that I represented the one way for him. When I told him, in essence, that he was not running his case or me anymore, his last prop was thus removed. He had no place to take his defiance and his grandiosity, nor could he become defiant with me. For his last bit of hope, and who actually had become established as an ultimate resource when he was in difficulty. So he staged a brief inward debate and then signed the card. The act of surrender had occurred. In short, the patient signed the card first, when all support was withdrawn, second, when he could not in anger defy those who withdrew their support because he knew that they had been patient and long-suffering, and third, when he found himself desperately needing help and had no grandiose ideas left about being able to drink like non-alcoholics. He had neither unconscious defiance nor grandiosity left to fight with. He was licked, and he both knew it and felt it.
Howard, would you like to comment?
Well, there's not a lot to say on that, is it? I mean, that's a step one surrender. You know, it's hitting bottom. You know, the final straw was his psychiatrist said, no, you're not running your case. You know, whatever makes that happen, you know, the final. I am interested in saying he knew that they'd been patient, long-suffering. I was not that empathetic at that point. That came later, but I mean, you know, my step one was reality sucks, you know. I'm not being able to do this. But, so, I mean, that's his accurate, I think, direct description of surrender in a patient.
Anybody else want to share?
So I'd like to share about my experience with what he says about, he said he was not willing to fit what he needed. And I didn't realize that's what happened until I read this, but whenever I come into AA this time, I had been in and out for about 8 years, and my sponsor told me, when I asked him to sponsor me, he told me, he said, I'll help you. He said, but we're going to do it my way. And the first time you buck on it, you can get someone else. And I don't know why I heard that, but I did. And I followed him around, did whatever he said, but I didn't know that's what happened until she just read this.
Yeah, this is Suzanne. Yeah, to me, too, it sounded like there were a lot of boundaries put down, you know, the signing of the card. And I find it interesting that I know some people have some sponsors that I know of, and I've done it, too, have people write something in the beginning of their big book and sign it. And what I've done is I ask some questions on are people willing to go to any length and things like that, and then have them sign it. And I never realized that that may have come from Dr. Tebow. So thanks. Anybody else like to share?
Well, this is Howard. I'd just like to agree that, you know, that action of signing, taking some sort of physical step to acknowledge is a powerful thing psychologically, you know.
And we also do it in step three. We take a vow.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie, would you like to continue with the positive phase?
Sure. The positive phase. We now reach the third question. Why does the positive phase follow? Here we frankly reach speculation. I know the positive phase comes, but not just why. Surrender means cessation of a fight, and cessation of a fight seems logical to be followed by internal peace and quiet. That point seems fairly obvious, but why the whole feeling tone switches from negative to positive without all the concomitant changes is not so clear. Nevertheless, despite my inability to explain the phenomenon, there is no question that the changes do take place and that they may be initiated by an act of surrender. Do you want me to stop there?
Sure. Howard, any comments on that?
Well, first, concomitant. How does it pronounce that? Concomitant. I don't know how to pronounce that. Anyway, it means happening at the same time. Concomitant, I would say. Anyway. Right, so he can't explain why the positive phase comes. This is something that might be more obvious to us, you know, because, you know, I regard that as the beginning of a spiritual experience, and that my accepting reality is opening the door to that spiritual experience, and that's why I feel better. You know, but he's saying that he can't explain why it comes, but he knows it does.
Anybody want to share on that?
Yeah, I would like to comment. This is Terry. I love this paragraph. I don't know why it hit me so hard, but, you know, I got next to the paragraph. It's like as soon as you give up the fight, and by giving up the fight, you actually win. So there's such a freedom when we let go of what really was never there. And, you know, I also have here, it's like being a cement marshmallow. Like I'm hard on the outside. I want to portray myself to be hot on the outside, but really I'm just a soft marshmallow inside. And as soon as I let go of everything, everything starts to go in a different positive direction. And that's what I get out of this paragraph.
What I find is interesting about the fight is when I was really able to see how I, like, emotionally do the fight, and just my whole fighting with myself, which I think in the past I never was able to really define so clearly as when I read this. And also kind of just looked at surrender for myself. Although I recognize that, he says surrender means cessation of a fight. And I also think it's really interesting that, you know, surrender is a battle and we give up. And that's it was just important for me to really see my process of giving up. And that was just tremendously helpful. Thanks. Anybody else like to share?
Yeah, hi, Suzanne and everyone. This is Karen. Thank you, everyone, for these comments. I agree with Terry. This paragraph really hit me, and just what you just said, too, Suzanne. Concomitant means a phenomenon that naturally accompanies or follows something. So, you know, he's saying in this paragraph, it's kind of confusing, like, without obvious changes to make a positive thing happen, it's kind of confusing. But when I think about this, like, I surrender when I finally accept that I have nowhere to go, nothing to do, and I'm relieved. So relieved that I don't have to believe that there's anything I can do about this anymore. I don't have to deny what's going on. I don't have to be in this delusion anymore. And it was the most amazing feeling for me when things were finally taken out of my incompetent hands. And that's what I get out of this paragraph, because the fight stops and it's over. And you know, now I'm bloodied and banged up and mangled, but now I can start to heal. And I can save face because there truly is nothing I can do about this. So ego actually stands down in this moment, and it's a beautiful moment. Thanks.
Anyone else? So we'll stop the reading part for today there. And then does anybody have any comments on what we read in entirety?
I just want to make one more comment about, you know, it talks about the willingness in a lot of the paragraphs, and what I've learned that, you know, surrender, and once I surrender, you know, willingness is a one-person job. Like, there's, like, nobody can give me that willingness to surrender to what I need to do to move in a positive phase. And, you know, what I've learned through the program is, yes, willingness is a one-person job, and there's two things that nobody can give us, and that's a higher power, who I choose to call God, and the willingness to do the process. And I just found those two things to be big obstacles when it comes to the alcoholic. And with that, I'll pass.
Thanks. Anybody else? Any final words? Any final words of wisdom?
Well, just to sum up, this is, you know, it's a look at the act of surrender, which, you know, it's step one, surrender. He's looked at the first time in these papers, he's looked at the factors that resist surrender. What is it in our personalities that makes us so extraordinarily resistant to seeing the reality of things, you know, that, hey, you've got a problem, you know, I've got a problem, and I don't want to see that. And then, you know, there's this phenomenon of, you know, hitting bottom and surrendering. And so he's just given a nice description of that. I wanted to say that last week's recording is up on tebow.egbot.com. So there's a recordings tab there. And this one will be up there as soon as I get done processing it. So we're going to be putting these recordings on an ongoing basis up on that website. So that's all I got.
Great. Thank you. Anybody else have any final parting words? So shall we say the serenity prayer together? And Stephanie, would you like to lead us?
Did you ask me if I wanted to lead it?
Yes.
Sure. God.
To accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change, the wisdom to know the difference.